This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Iran has dominated the news this week. And as we start to know more, the decision by President Trump to kill Iran's top general has had consequences that are being felt far beyond the Middle East. Australia continues to struggle with devastating bushfires, and Buckingham Palace finds itself in a very different kind of firefight. So, lots to talk about on this Friday News Roundup. My guests are Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, an executive editor for Foreign Affairs. Daniel is the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945-1947, and he joins us from New York. Daniel, great to have you.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Also, we welcome back Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst, vice president and director of the International Security Program at New America. His latest book is called Trump and His Generals, The Cost of Chaos. Peter, it's great to see you again.
Thank you.
Well, in the early dark hours of Wednesday morning, Iran launched two missile strikes on two bases in Iraq that are home to U.S. troops. Those attacks, of course, put the world on edge, but both sides now appear to be stepping back from the brink of war. On the same night as that missile strike, though, Ukraine International Airlines flight PS752 crashed just after taking off from the Iranian capital, killing all 176 passengers and crew who were on board. Evidence now suggests that it was a missile that brought down that plane. Peter, let's start with the Iranian missile attack on the military bases. What happened, and maybe more important than what happened in that attack, what didn't happen in that attack?
Well, you know, first of all, the Iranians warned the Iraqi government it was going to happen, and the Iraqi government then warned the U.S. government that it was going to happen. So, in a sense, you know, the fix was in that there would be no casualties. It was intended to produce no casualties. It was intended to be some kind of response by the Iranians. But we know from the attack, you recall in June, the attack on the Abqaiq oil facility, which is the most important oil facility arguably in the world in Saudi Arabia, which was conducted almost certainly by the Iranians. That attack was conducted with pinpoint accuracy. So the Iranians had the capability, if they wanted, to kill lots of Americans on these bases, but they obviously chose not to.
And obviously, that means they wanted to de-escalate any kind of coming confrontation. But there are a lot of steps there. You're kind of shooting wide. You're warning the troops they can all get into hardened bunkers. It seems like Iran took a lot of intentional steps to send a very clear signal. We're not looking for this kind of trouble right now.
But also, they didn't do it through proxies. It was an Iranian government attack. And the New York Times had a fascinating piece about Ayatollah Khomeini. Apparently, he doesn't go to their National Security Council meetings very often. But he came in and said, you know, we are going to respond, not our proxies. You know, this has to be us. It has to be clearly us. So, you know, I mean, the conflict is not over. After all, the conflict's been going on for more than four decades between the United States and Iran. And we just had a press conference by Secretary of State Pompeo and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin where they announced new sanctions. Now, it's hard to imagine a country that could be more sanctioned than Iran, which is its economy is in the tank because of the existing sanctions. But they're sanctioning additional individuals, and I guess they're putting sanctions on steel. And
yeah, we understand steel and iron tariffs, sanctions against eight individuals, some of the sanctions that were promised by President Trump earlier in the week. Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, new sanctions now. We've been asking this question a lot this week, and I think we have to keep asking it. New sanctions on an Iranian economy that's already staggering under the weight of sanctions. What does this do to Iran's incentives? We've de-escalated this week. That's great. What about the incentives going forward in the days and weeks to come in the Persian Gulf?
I think there's a sense of relief that we've gotten through this first round in a week or so since the killing of Soleimani. Without greater damage, there were immediate fears that there'd be some massive escalation. And that has not happened. As Peter pointed out, it's been a relatively careful response. And there's some sense that we're returning to regularly scheduled programming in the region, which is not exactly a positive dynamic. It's the U.S. sanctioning an already very sanctioned Iranian economy. It's Iran likely returning to the kind of regional mischief making that it has been up to for especially in the last year or so. But it's unlikely to really change the dynamic, which highlights in some ways the strategic result of the strike. While we've gotten through this week without catastrophe, in some ways, the U.S. emerges from this in a worse position than it was in even a week ago. The Iranians, rather than being protesting against their own government due to their own economic hardship, are united against the United States in a way they haven't been for a little while. You have the Iraqis trying to press the United States to leave Iraq, and there's some risk that that will happen, which will be a cost to the United States. And then you have, of course, the announcement by the Iranian government that it would continue to blow through some of the restrictions on its nuclear program. And we should recall that all of this started over Iran's nuclear program. That's really the heart of the matter. And we are in no better shape there than we were a week ago, and in some ways in worse shape.
Well, there are a range of voices coming out of Iran speaking to this very point about what Iran expects and wants from the coming weeks and months. Earlier this week, NPR's Mary Louise Kelly spoke to Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif.
It's an act of terrorism and an act of war. It violated territorial integrity and sovereignty of Iraq, and that is why the Iraqis decided to kick them out. It hurt the feeling of many people across Iran and the rest of the world. That is why I say the days of the United States in our region are numbered.
Daniel Zarif wants a Middle East with no U.S. soldiers in it. That's his dream for Iraq. Is he going to get that wish anytime soon?
In some ways, Donald Trump might have the same dream. You know, there's been this strange incoherence or tension in his policy. On the one hand, he wants to look tough, wants to show that he was tougher than Barack Obama. But on the other hand, he has said again and again that he does not want endless war. So something like a withdrawal from Iraq may in some ways suit both the interests of the Iranian government and of Donald Trump, who I imagine would like to go into this upcoming presidential campaign able to say that he has not started new wars and has in fact ended the endless wars in the region. But the question of whether we can get back to some kind of deal, of course, when Trump spoke on Wednesday, he talked about wanting peace with Iran. And there's very little reason to see why Iran would enter into a new negotiation with the United States right now. The dynamic is really not looking good on that score.
Kevin writes, Twitter was buzzing with speculation that Iran was on hair trigger alert because conservative pundits like Sean Hannity were spreading false information, especially that American B-52 bombers were on their way to the Persian Gulf. Let's get a fact check. Peter, do you know anything about that Iranian calculus or whether they were worried about rhetoric that was coming from Fox News?
I have no idea. But just picking up on what you and Daniel were discussing, I mean, the Iraqi prime minister has already told Secretary of State Pompeo or his office that they should start preparing the discussions about the U.S. troop withdrawal. Now, you know, one of the big themes that Trump had during the campaign was the effects that the December 2011 troop withdrawal from Iraq and Obama and kind of basically that was a wrong decision, which led to ISIS. And so, I mean, yes, it may be in Trump's kind of interests in some ways to pull out of Iraq, but also it would kind of undercut a key theme that he's made, which is, you know, he's the guy who defeated ISIS and he kind of set the conditions for that. So, you know, let's see. But I mean, I think that a withdrawal of American troops from Iraq is highly likely. Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who's really the most important political figure in Iraq, even before the strike against Soleimani, said that the earlier strikes against targets in Iraq were a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. And I think that is a very big message.
Now, speaking of U.S. troops leaving Iraq, heads were spinning in Washington when a memo came out of the Pentagon this week suggesting that American troops were already on the move, that they might be leaving Iraq, they might be headed toward Kuwait, that they were redeploying. Peter, your book is all about chaos and how it affects President Trump and his foreign policy. I saw this weird news that happened for a couple of minutes this week, confusion, big mistakes made at the Pentagon, and it made me think of you and the thesis of your book.
Yeah, well, I mean, this may just be somebody getting ahead of their skis, and the letter wasn't signed, and it wasn't an official communication, and the Pentagon was pretty quick to come out and say it wasn't an official communication. But I do think it is interesting that the cast of characters in my book, the generals that surrounded President Trump in the first 2 years of his administration, had great experience in the Middle East and great experience in conducting wars. And the people that he has around him now, a lot of them have almost no experience in the Middle East and don't have the clout or the experience to really kind of counter the president. And so when the Soleimani decision was made, I very much doubt that there was a, here are the 57 different things that can happen if you do that. It was more of a, gut call by the president. And, was it a bold move or a reckless gamble? I think we're beginning to see it's more of the latter because, ultimately, I think we do want a presence in Iraq of some kind to prevent ISIS coming back, to have some leverage in the region. And that doesn't have to be a large presence, but I think getting thrown out doesn't help American interests.
At the same time, Peter, I want to point out, we heard very little from Israel within the last week, except a statement effectively saying we had nothing to do with this and we want no part of it. I would have thought maybe if you had asked me a week and a half ago that the Likud government of Israel might cheerlead at an attack like this, and they really didn't.
Yeah, interesting observation. I mean, obviously, Israel has its own political problems right now. At the end of the day, they're going to go along for the ride, whatever the United States, the world superpower, does. So they may just felt there was no upside in taking a public position.
It's the Friday News Roundup. I'm speaking with Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst, vice president and director of the International Security Program at New America. Also, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor at Foreign Affairs. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk a little bit more about Iran, also about war powers, the power of the president to wage further war against Iran should it come up, and what's happening in Congress to try to rein him in, and a lot more of the world's news. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. From WAMU and NPR. It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Back to the Friday News Roundup with Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor at Foreign Affairs, and Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst, vice president and director of the International Security Program at New America. Later on in the hour, don't worry, we will be joined by BBC's correspondent in London, their royal correspondent, to talk about the dramatic turn of events at Buckingham Palace. So do stay tuned for that. I want to get back to questions of war and war powers here, though. The events in Iraq this past week, gentlemen, prompted this renewed debate over here over war powers and the president, what powers he has when it comes to the use of force. On Thursday on this show, I spoke to Democratic Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine for years has been pounding the table on Congress's squandering of its war powers. And here's what he told me.
I think Congress is chicken, basically. A war vote is really hard. I've had to cast two in the foreign relations committees, and I realized as a guy who's cast thousands of votes as a senator and a city councilman, this is much harder than any vote I've ever cast. I have a child in the military.
Daniel, the House has voted to restrain President Trump in future war actions with Iran. The Senate will see. This definitely matters to lawmakers, of course. What about the rest of us? Why is this an important debate?
What has been so striking about the last couple of decades, ever since 9/11, is how many things the U.S. military has done in the world, how many different fights it has fought, with really very little debate in Congress, very little public scrutiny from our representatives in Congress, very little real consideration of each one of those acts. And what you saw from House Democrats on Thursday was an attempt, on the one hand, to try to reverse that, to try to make at least a symbolic stand against the president being able to go to war or take an act of war without going and consulting with Congress first. But it also really served to highlight just how much Congress's powers on this have been eviscerated over the last few decades. In some ways, it's because Congress has given them away, as Tim Kaine alluded to. In some cases, it's because the White House, under both parties, has really tried to claim these powers for itself. So it's unlikely that even with Democratic unity on these war powers issues, it's really going to do much to constrain the president from taking moves that he wants. And that's even more true at a time when there's any number of ways that this could spiral out of control on the ground. We haven't talked much about the Ukrainian Airlines flight yesterday, but that's just really a sort of tragic coda to this round, and a reminder that when the region's on hair trigger alert and you have crews on the ground with surface-to-air missiles, anything can go wrong very, very quickly. And if you imagine what would have happened if that had been a U.S. airplane, you can imagine things getting bad very quickly without Congress having much of an ability to do anything about
it. Well, it's very, very interesting, David, that plane crash or shoot down just outside of Tehran's airport. A lot of people have pointed to at least a series of circumstantial facts that you just mentioned. It's impossible to know what would have or would not have happened but for, but they are in a high threat environment there in Tehran right now. And what is also true is that a passenger jet with 270 souls aboard appears to have been shot down.
That's right. And it's, you know, in some ways, this kind of nightmarish mashup of all the grim stories of 2019 come back to greet us in the new year. The fact that you have Ukraine, Iran, and Boeing all wrapped into one story is kind of particularly grim. But it also really is a reminder of just what it means for all these forces in a very complicated region to be on this kind of alert. That could spin out of control very, very quickly.
176 people aboard that Ukrainian jet, I should say. The Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, is paying tribute to 63 Canadians killed aboard that jet. He said that all evidence suggests that the plane had been brought down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile.
This new information reinforces the need for a thorough investigation into this matter. Canada is working with its allies to ensure that a thorough and credible investigation is conducted to determine the causes of this fatal crash. As I said yesterday, Canadians have questions and they deserve answers.
Peter, if it does turn out to be confirmed that indeed a passenger jet was shot down over Tehran by Iranian surface-to-air missile, what then?
Well, right now the Iranians are denying it, but their denials seem highly implausible because Occam's razor can be employed, meaning, you know, the simplest explanation of anything is often the actual explanation. And when the Iranians were on high alert and a missile goes off, which brings down a commercial airliner, it's reminiscent a little bit of the USS Vincennes bringing down an Iranian passenger plane and killing almost 300 people on board in 1988. It was a mistake. The United States government eventually admitted it was a mistake and provided compensation. One hopes that the Iranians will come to that conclusion because clearly other explanations don't seem very plausible.
Steve tweets this. I'm curious to hear about the panel's thoughts about reports that Secretary Pompeo himself pushed Trump hard on Soleimani's killing. Does that seem plausible to you, Peter, that the pressure on the president, who does not have a career studying Middle Eastern political affairs, was pushed hard by his Secretary of State to get tough on Iran?
100%. I mean, if you look at the composition of the cabinet, Pompeo is really kind of the last. Pompeo and to some degree Mnuchin are two of the sort of survivors here. And Pompeo has a close relationship with the president. He said publicly last year that God had put Trump on, that it is quite possible that God had put Trump on the earth to save Israel from Iran. So that's, and he's a hardcore kind of Christian fundamentalist who really believes these things, and has had a bee in his bonnet about Iran and Soleimani for apparently a long time.
Daniel, it hasn't escaped the attention of a lot of people that the administration's justification for the strike on Qasem Soleimani, imminent threat, that the threat was imminent, he was planning attacks on Americans, relies on information from the intelligence services, the intelligence community. And Mark writes, I'm wondering if this imminent danger to the U.S. was discovered by the very same intelligence agency that President Trump has basically called inept. And worse, it is the same intelligence agency. Is it harder for the administration to sell the United States, even sell the world, on the idea of imminent threat after the president has gone after his own intelligence officials in the way that he has?
It's a really great point, and it was striking that even a Republican Senator Mike Lee, after hearing a briefing from senior administration representatives about the intelligence, came out and said it was one of the worst briefings he'd ever heard. What this reminds us is that Donald Trump's credibility is low both with Americans and with the world when it comes to these kinds of statements, and especially so because he has spent so much time disparaging the intelligence analysts that he whose authority he wants to invoke now. He spent so much time disparaging the allies who he's now calling on to do more to help us in the Middle East, and he spent so much time disparaging the kinds of expertise that would normally kind of provide good policymaking process in this time. You know, he talks about the deep state. The deep state is really the people who make sure that letters that are unsigned don't go out. To, you know, go back to what Peter was referring to, the letter about the withdrawal from Iraq. I'd also just add on Pompeo, it's notable that Mike Pompeo really came to prominence talking about Benghazi, about the attack on a U.S. compound in Benghazi. And when he saw a similar breach of a U.S. compound in Baghdad by Iranian-backed forces, that really became a kind of triggering thing for Secretary Pompeo. And it was hard for him not to respond, given how much prominence he'd given to the Benghazi issue just a few years ago.
It became a campaign for him, you might say. I want to check in on a story that has been underreported in our American press, but very important. Three Americans were killed on Sunday in Kenya. The terrorist organization Al-Shabaab says it was responsible for the deaths of one U.S. serviceman and two contractors with the U.S. Department of Defense. The latest attack comes just over a week after Al-Shabaab truck bomb in Somalia killed at least 79 people. Peter, this is the first direct attack by Al-Shabaab on U.S. personnel, and it makes me wonder why now.
It's hard for me to answer that, but I think that the story would have got a lot more play absent, you know, the drama around Iran and impeachment. Go back to the Niger story where you had four American special forces killed. A lot of Americans were sort of surprised that we had U.S. forces in Niger. Probably a lot of Americans are surprised we have U.S. forces in Kenya. So I think it got kind of there was such a lot of coverage of other stories. In a normal news cycle, this would have got a lot more attention. Al-Shabaab, of course, is it's been affiliated with Al-Qaeda. There's a part of it that's split off and is affiliated with ISIS. So I mean, why they would attack Americans? These are, you know, these groups are anti-American as part of their sort of DNA.
Dan, you contrasted the reaction to Benghazi and the incursion there with the reaction to an incursion in Baghdad just a couple of weeks ago. The contrast stands out, and so does another one. One American was killed by an attack in Iraq, and the U.S. responded with deadly force. That's just in this past week or two. So far, we've seen no such response here in Kenya, where U.S. servicemen and two contractors were killed by a terrorist group.
Yeah, it's a really great point. And the fact that this has gotten so little coverage is in some ways indicative of how much certain issues tend to swallow all of our attention in the Trump era. This comes in the context of a couple of important policy moves and debates on these issues and on the region. The first is that the Trump administration really has ramped up strikes on Al-Shabaab in Somalia. So even as we pay attention to events elsewhere, there's been a real escalation in drone strikes on this group. So this is yet another American war that we're not paying attention to. This also comes in the context of a debate about whether to withdraw U.S. forces from Africa in large numbers, whether we should be paying more attention to threats like Russia and China and focusing our military resources there. This attack is a reminder of why the United States has gotten stuck in these places for so long.
And might remind us of another fact that has been on my mind quite a lot lately, that overall drone strikes, places like Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, under President Trump are up significantly from what they were during President Obama's presidency up until now. President Obama was singled out, and rightfully so, for relying on the drone wars. President Trump has done more. There are more drone attacks under this president than before, worth remembering, and worth remembering when news like Kenya comes up and we don't pay much attention to it. I want to take us to Australia because there is a continuation of devastating news from Australia. Australia is still burning. 27 people have died since those fires began in late summer, and more than a billion animals have likely been killed, according to a recent estimate from the University of Sydney. The United States has now sent firefighters to help as nearly 18 million acres of Australia have burned. We're seeing terrible images out of Australia, Peter. Blood red skies, overwhelming smoke, even kangaroos huddling on suburban lawns seeking refuge from the flames in their normal habitat. What do we know about these extreme fires? A lot of people are linking them directly to climate change, including President Barack Obama. It makes sense that that conversation tails right on coverage of the actual destruction in Australia. What do we know?
Well, the fires are now 1.5 million acres in size, and sort of individual fires have kind of linked up into one mega fire. 2019 was the hottest year on record in Australia, so that surely has something to do with climate change. This has become a political issue in Canada because certain MPs and the Prime Minister's own party have kind of suggested that this is really not about climate change. It's more about the accumulation of fuel and forests rather than some systematic problem that is going to affect Australia going forward. Craig Kelly, who's a MP in Australia, attracted a fair amount of attention when he suggested that this wasn't really linked to climate change. And there was outrage that Morrison, the Prime Minister, had gone to Hawaii on vacation in the middle of all this. So it's become a politically very charged issue in Australia.
Dan, do you think this changes the conversation at all? Many Australians might be more convinced now of the direct and imminent perils of climate change now that their country's on fire. Statements like this from their politicians seem shocking.
Yeah, it in some ways serves to highlight how polarized and how partisan the climate change issue has become, not just in the United States, but globally. On the one hand, things like fires and floods and increased hurricanes seem to provide very, very vivid evidence of the effects of climate change, which for a long time have been sort of abstract and far off. We're suddenly seeing them in our day-to-day lives in very tragic and horrific form. It's not that any one of these events is necessarily caused directly by climate change, but the likelihood of them and the severity grows. So you see that on the one hand. On the other hand, the politics of this have become in some ways worse than they were 10 or 15 years ago, with parties in Australia and the United States splitting entirely on how to interpret these events. And internationally, it's worth noting that just last month, there was a failed UN climate summit in Madrid. And so for all the focus on these fires, for all the kind of vivid and terrible toll that we see on TV or in photographs, there's really been very, very little in terms of international action to address the root cause of climate change.
And yet, Dan, fires of this magnitude might serve to be one of the best warnings about climate change, because climate scientists tell us no specific weather event can be connected to climate change, but fires are directly connected to temperature. The hotter it gets, the hotter fires burn, the longer fire season is. We've already been warned there is no longer a fire season in California. It's fires all the time, and there's a reason for that.
That's right. That is certainly the correct interpretation, but the political debate seems to contest that in ways that don't lead to great hope, at least in my mind, for serious political action at the national and international level, which means it falls much more to individual communities, to local governments, state governments, and the private sector to really address this.
But Peter, I'm sure that that's correct. On the other hand, this event in Australia is not a local event. It's not a state event. It is a national tragedy and a national emergency. It's huge. Does that potentially have any crystallizing effect?
I'm going to agree with Daniel. People's kind of positions on this are so entrenched. I mean, the United States is out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And, you know, President Trump had a choice on that. He could have said, I don't believe in the science around this, but I do believe it's happening. And I'm a builder and we can, you know, create infrastructure in places like Palm Beach and Manhattan, where I have houses to prevent the effects of climate change in these places. He hasn't done that.
We're going to have more from our guests. We're going to have more from you in just a moment. But before we pause, here's breaking news from about 500 million light years away. This week, astronomers in Europe pinpointed the location of mysterious radio signals called FRBs. That stands for fast radio bursts. This is only the second time that scientists have determined the precise location of these radio waves coming from space. Now, only this time, these FRBs are thought to come from a galaxy that's 7 times closer than the only other repeating bursts that we've ever detected or localized. Now, scientists still don't know where these mysterious repeating bursts come from. Guesses include things like black holes, giant solar flares, even aliens sending messages. We don't know, but let me say this. Boom, science. I'm Todd Zwillick, it's 1A. let's go to London. Let's go to England. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex, otherwise known as Harry Windsor and Meghan Markle, they dropped a bombshell this week. The Sussexes said they plan to take a step back from their roles as senior royals and move toward financial independence. While Harry did alert his father, Prince Charles, of these plans, reports suggest that the Queen and the rest of the royal house were not consulted before those plans went public. The couple were married in 2018. They have one son. His name is Archie. And right now, Archie's great-grandmother, she is not amused. On the line from London is the BBC's royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. Johnny, thanks for being here.
Hey, my pleasure, Todd. Good to talk.
Johnny, the Her Majesty the Queen is not amused. We'll get to why. What exactly are Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, trying to do here?
Well, I think exactly is the problem. It's very difficult to know what exactly they want, but a bit more hazily, they want to, in their own phrase, step back from being senior royals and instead kind of create a hybrid position where part of the time they are leading their own independent lives, unmolested as they would see it by the intrusions of the media, and where they're able to take jobs, take professions, and, as they say, work towards financial independence and still remain part of the royal family, carry out royal duties, and be duke and duchesses, but under their own terms, it seems, and to their own satisfaction rather than within the more tightly controlled system of the royal family.
Johnny, I have to say, if we're being honest, our unrelenting interest in the royal family is prurient. It's certainly celebrity driven, and that's part of this story. But at the same time, what they are trying to do, it does have substantive concerns in England, in the UK, does it not? I mean, there actually might be something wrong with this from the view of the royal family and people who support them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what they're doing is overturning the theory of hereditary obligation, that when you are born into the royal family, a deal is struck at the moment of your birth that you will receive, you know, relative luxury, and in exchange for that, you will serve and you will carry out duties, and that is by birth. And you don't really have any choice in that. And Harry and Meghan, but I think primarily Harry, perhaps assisted by Meghan, are saying, we want another model. We don't want that automatic requirement to be royals or to be royal and to carry out that life. We want something else. Yeah, it's a big deal. It strikes at the heart of the bargain, the deal, the contract, the situation that you have when you have a hereditary monarchy.
Dave writes, they have millions in the bank courtesy of the British taxpayer. They are hugely marketable. Let's face it, retired at 35 from anything even resembling a real job. Maybe millions in the bank, Johnny, but how does a royal, how do they go about being financially independent? I mean, good on them. They want to make their own way. That sounds great. Is that complicated when you're a royal?
Yeah, it's really complicated. I mean, and that's why essentially serving royals do not take private jobs, because as soon as they do, if they do, they open themselves up to charges of conflicts of interest, of monetizing the royal family, of exploiting the brand. It's exceptionally difficult. Yes, of course, they are hugely high-profile figures. They have astonishing sort of pull power as influencers. They are, you know, top rank. But are they really going to start, you know, wearing a special kind of watch when they go out and then gently advertise that on their social media and make money through that? What happens if they're then wearing the same watch when they're doing royal duties? It very quickly starts to corrupt the institution. And this is the stuff they have to work out. So this is the stuff that the palace and the household, which are now ranged on different sides, have to work out. And how are they going to liaise with each other, the palace and the new court? This court, which we think will be set up split between the UK and, they say, North America, and most people seem to understand Canada as that. So it's really, really complicated. And it wasn't helped originally by the way this announcement was made. And I don't mean to correct you, but Prince Charles got 10 minutes warning. I mean, there'd been some conversations, very, very early conversations, the palace tells me, about a future role. But otherwise, nothing. And then 10 minutes beforehand, bing, is into his inbox, and comes the statement, and no conversation, no consultation, no word with the Queen.
And when the bing bonged over London, there was a response from Buckingham Palace that was unmistakably curt.
Oh,
basically,
they were pissed.
They were. I'm paraphrasing, but it basically said, this is more complicated than they think, and none of this has been settled. It was about a two-line statement.
Yeah.
Hey, I spoke with Anne McElvoy, your colleague from The Economist, before we came on the air, and she was adamant that these two warring factions, who happened to be Buckingham Palace and the Queen and her great-grandson, the Duke of Sussex, need to find some way forward.
They can't simply carry on in this war of sort of froideur coming from Queen Elizabeth's team and a slightly, well, up yours on Instagram, coming from the Sussexes. It might be satisfactory in the short term. It makes clear that each have their interests, but they won't be able to do business like this. And one thing the firm has to do, it has to keep doing the royal business. It's what it's there for.
The firm. And yet, Johnny, I don't think anyone is going to convince Prince Harry to be okay with the British tabloid press involved intimately in his life and Meghan's life, especially given his personal history with them.
Todd, media intrusion is part of this. What the Duke and Duchess see as intrusion, what the other royals have learnt to live with, it's partly that. It's also that Harry is visibly bored by the ceremonial aspects of the job. And I've spent a fair amount of time travelling with him. And, you know, he's sitting there just, he can't hide it. And he doesn't see why he should. And he's growing up. He's, you know, in his early middle age. He's got a kid. He's starting to think, I've got other things I'd like to be doing rather than, you know, paying visits to South Pacific Islands or whatever it is. So it's not just the media, although that is a big part of it. Now, to your bigger point, the palace and the household now need to sort things out. Yeah, they do. They do need to, but don't underestimate how difficult this is. Harry and Meghan have said, we want to do something different, and we want to do it under our rules, and we want to do it with our people, and we want to do it at a distance. That may or may not be possible. It may be that they end up actually having to leave the royal family entirely because it's too difficult to make this new relationship work. That having been said, I was having a chat with someone from the palace earlier today who said, look, we have struggled over the last 30, 40 years with what to do with the people who are not in line to the throne, the sort of the brothers of the people in line to the throne and the sisters of it. And it's been a real challenge. It's been a real problem. And now we have a chance to try and sort it out. They're just sorting it out under pretty high time pressure and in a very high profile way. So they may struggle. We'll see.
This may have been a missed opportunity. I mean, if that problem is a problem for the royal household, they may have had a proof of concept that could have really worked for them, except it seems like Harry and Meghan may have forced their hand. Johnny, I got to let you go. I got a question for you before you
go.
Look, from This American, I got to paraphrase Boromir of Gondor from Lord of the Rings and say that America has no king. America needs no king, nor a queen. And yet, we are so very obsessed with everything this family does. Why? Why?
It's a fairy tale. I mean, it's great. It's got kings and queens and princes and rules and equerries. It's not important, but it's interesting. It's fun. I always say that they are like a government department dedicated to fun or good times or just escapism. It's just something different. It's quite nice to do when everything else seems so difficult, to think about something fantastical.
Melinda writes, why not abdicate? This half-in, half-out approach puts them open to criticism from taxpayers. They could support charities, the monarchy, and anything else important to them as private citizens, albeit very rich and famous private citizens. And last word to Yolanda, who writes, everyone wants to come after Meghan as if Harry hasn't always wanted out and been controversial. Johnny Diamond, BBC Royal Correspondent. Johnny, your guidance means a great deal to me at a moment like this. Thank you so much.
Todd, it's been a real pleasure. Have a good one.
All right. There goes Johnny Diamond to the BBC. You two gentlemen who are left with me, Peter Bergen and Daniel Kurtzphalen, I want to take the remainder of the time that we have together to get inside of your heads a little bit about stories that we're not paying attention to that we should be, things that you're working on or things that you're thinking about. Peter, you are looking at me in a very thankful way that I did not subject you to this story about the Sussexes of England. So since I excused you from that, indulge me on this. What stories are on your mind that are important that we're not thinking enough about?
Well, you know, a story that is often in mind, I was in Afghanistan earlier last month, and you know, the war obviously hasn't gone away. The situation there is quite pretty bad. I mean, I've been visiting for the last 2.5 decades, and this is probably the worst situation it's been in since 9/11. As a Western reporter, you can only really travel by armored car, and you have to be pretty careful about kind of what you do in terms of being out on the streets. And, you know, the war continues. And what's interesting to me, Todd, is that President Trump is kind of at the same place that President Obama was on Afghanistan at the end of his second term, which is they're about the same number of troops, a little over 8,000 in both cases. There is sort of discussions about talking to the Taliban, which have gone back and forth. It seems that President Trump, earlier in the show, you were talking about the use of drones and the use of, you know, there's so many commonalities between Trump and Obama once you strip away kind of a lot of the rhetoric in terms of the way they've treated these wars on terror, using basically drones, special operations forces, cyber warfare, and not big conventional forces. But it's interesting to me that Trump is kind of in the same place that Obama was in terms of the decision making around Afghanistan, because as I document in my new book, General Dunford, who was then the chairman the Joint Chief, said, you know, the only, basically, you know, staying in Afghanistan is like life insurance. You know, no one wants to pay life insurance, but you do it because it's, you know, not smart not to. And, you know, basically, the only thing worse than leaving Afghanistan, the only thing worse than staying in Afghanistan is leaving precipitously and having kind of it collapse in chaos. So the Afghan story goes on. It's the longest war in American history. And it hasn't gone away.
Dan Kurtzfallon, I have the same question for you. Stories that you're thinking about that you think we should pay more attention to or things that are in your notebook.
So I think that the souring relationship between the United States and China will continue to be one of the most important stories this year. We're likely to see some kind of trade deal next week, a so-called phase one trade deal, which may end the kind of tit-for-tat tariff war that's dominated headlines over the last year. But that really just leads to the bigger question about what kind of relationship the United States and China are going to have. And I think we're going to see in the presidential campaign that there is a fair amount of bipartisan consensus on the tougher approach to China that Donald Trump has really started. What Democrats are going to say is not that we should not be as tough on China, but that we should be smarter about it. So it'll be a debate about the how rather than the what. And there are so many big questions that are really going to be at play in ways that have consequences for decades ahead on the economic relationship, the security issues, you know, the question of how and whether we can cooperate on global issues like climate change. The U.S. and China are the two biggest economies in the world, the two biggest carbon emitters. If we can't get together to establish some kind of cooperation on climate change, it's very, very unlikely that the world's going to do much about it. So all of that is going to play out over the coming years. Over the course of this year, and how that goes, both in the presidential campaign and more broadly, is going to have consequences that go beyond so much of what we talk about day to day. It seems fitting that we've spent the first several days of 2020 consumed with events in the Middle East, because in some ways, the big story of U.S. foreign policy over the past 20 years or so is the United States being distracted by military action in a chaotic Middle East while China rises. And the first week of 2020 has been a vivid demonstration of that.
Peter, you and I spoke a little bit about China last week and increasing American naval activity, trying to pare back China in the South China Seas and their ambitions. But to Dan's point before we go, do you think there is enough common interest potentially between the United States and China, that this inevitably adversarial relationship could at least have a common vision that doesn't lead to conflict? I mean, we want their markets. They love our stuff. Maybe that's enough to keep people getting along.
Well, the Trump administration, as Daniel knows better than almost anybody, has taken a much more skeptical approach to China. And I think appropriately so. More freedom of navigation exercises that you mentioned, Todd, in the South China Sea. And, you know, the real question is, does China have a Monroe Doctrine for Asia, basically, which is they want us out? Or do they have bigger ambitions? And I think, to sort of displace us as the world superpower. And it's probably not clear to them. It's not clear to us. These things can be managed. Often and they don't end well. It was managed between the British and the United States when Britain was the dominant power and the United States was the rising power. But in general, often this leads to conflict.
To the point, this is a good time for me to tell you, the 1A listener, that the president's top trade advisor, Peter Navarro, will be joining us on Monday to talk about phase one of that trade deal and the way forward with China as he sees it and his boss see it from the Oval Office. Make sure you join us then. My thanks for now go to Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor at Foreign Affairs. Daniel, it's always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst, author of Trump and His Generals, The Cost of Chaos. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Earlier on, Johnny Diamond, BBC's royal correspondent, who walked us through the Megxit, I think we're calling it, the exit of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, also Anne McElvoy from The Economist, who joined us from across the pond. You'll find the 1A podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It's a great way to catch up with the Friday News Roundup and all of our other shows. This podcast was produced by Matthew Simonson. 1A's senior producers are Paige Osborne and Danielle Knight. This program, as always, comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. Enjoy your weekend. Follow those royals. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.